we're going to talk about double scope cognition, and I thought I'd mention a little bit about the history of the development of this theory. It began in earnest in 1992 and early 1993 when I was at the University of California, San Diego. I had been working on various problems in conceptual projection, and so had Gilles Faulconnier. I gave a presentation at Ron Laniker's house, and Gilles was in the audience, in which I talked about certain data I had that could not be analyzed on any existing theory of conceptual projection, including my own. And this caused me difficulties, and I indicated that I thought we needed some new theory and sketched some tiny beginnings. And Gilles Faulconnier immediately stood up and said that he had similar examples and presented them. And so we decided that the next day we would write a little article. But as soon as we started to write this little article, it exploded, and now this collaboration has been going on for 17 years. In that time, hundreds of other people have maybe by now 1,000, have contributed to the theory, sometimes quite substantially, not just to applications of the theory, but also to theoretical developments. If you want to see the history of these things, go to blending.stanford.edu, and you will see there hundreds of articles and citations by people all around the world working in theory of conceptual integration in a variety of fields. So you remember this was a typical network, and you remember we saw, well, typical network, not to go too fast. The theory is not four spaces and some lines. And in fact, what the diagram looks like does not matter. Conceptual integration is a basic mental operation. It happens all the time. It happens according to a set of constitutive and governing principles, and it happens over all conceptual networks. This is just here so I have something to point at when I'm talking. I can say that there are always a couple of input spaces, sometimes many more. There are always some kinds of connections developed between the input spaces. There is always selective projection to the blend and emergent structure there. So you saw the example of a Buddhist monk. Buddhist monk gets up at dawn, walks up the mountain path, reaches the top at dusk, sits down, meditates overnight, gets up at dawn, walks up the mountain path, reaches it at dusk, sits down, meditates overnight, rises at dawn, goes back down the path, reaching the beginning of the path at dusk. And you're supposed to prove, without assuming anything about how the monk moves, that there is a spot on the path that he occupies at the same hour of the day on the two separate days. One way to do that is to blend the ascent and the descent selectively. That is, you do not bring in the calendrical day. You do not bring in the usual psychology of someone who would be terrified to see himself approaching himself on the path. You do not bring in normal physics. You bring in the monks, but you bring them in separately. You bring in the path, but you fuse the paths. And there is emergent structure, namely, the monks meet. They have to meet somewhere, and wherever they meet is the spot on the path that they occupy at the same hour of the day on the two successive days. So you have proved this. There is emergent structure, the meeting, which solves the problem. The important thing is not to have the blend in this case. It's that the blend lets you understand relationships in the network that you didn't previously understand. Purpose of the blend is to run the network. It's crucial in this that what always counts is the network. What is developing in the network? And now you have language for referring to this network. You can say the place is where the monk meets himself. You have this word meet, and you have this word himself, and they're perfect for the blend. They are ungrammatical for the input spaces. In the original story, there was no meeting and there was no himself. It's now grammatical for the blend, and so you can talk about the blend in a way that lets people understand the network. Okay, there are always input spaces, there are always some kind of vital relation connections between them that start off the blend. There is a generic space, often not recognized, but frequently very useful, that contains what ends up being the shared structure in the network. It's not the case that it's always there to begin with. There is projection to the blended space and emergent meaning in the blended space, typical network. Now, I said that there were types of networks, but today, what I want to do for about the first 15 minutes is spend a lot of time avoiding mistakes, avoiding misimpressions. When I show you these blends, they look goofy, strange, bizarre, Buddhist monk meeting himself, riddles, and this can mislead. Similarly, when I say there are different kinds of networks, this can mislead. It's common for people who study to look at a network and say, oh, now is this a simplex? Is this a mirror? Is this a single scope? Or is this a double scope network? No. Blending works over conceptual networks, but there are certain patterns that arise again and again. So think of it like, you know, there are lots of numbers, and there's 0 and 100 and negative 100. And those are cognitive reference points. That's not to say that there are not numbers all in between. In the same sort of way, there are plenty of patterns that are not exactly simplex, not exactly mirror, maybe they're a little of both. They're not exactly single scope, they're not exactly double scope. But it's good to have these as reference points. So, for example, a simplex network is typically what, in the history of psychology, people have called framing. And you might say, well, wait a minute, if we already have a term for this, and people have already recognized it, then why have it inside the theory of conceptual integration? And that's a major point. The point is, these things are not separate operations. They are aspects of conceptual integration, and many things that have taken to be separate phenomena or impressions or appearances are products or phenomena that arise in mental space working. So a simplex network is when you have a frame that is built to apply to a certain kind of conceptual domain. So, for example, we have a frame of kinship, and it can vary from culture to culture. But in our frame of kinship, at least the one that I have, there's always an ego point, that's the I, that's where you measure things from, and you have things like father and mother, right? Now, there are no people in there, that's a frame, but it's designed to apply to people. So when you take some particular people, like Paul and Sally, notice in this input on the left, there are just two people, Paul and Sally. That's all there is. And in the input on the right, rather, there's Paul and Sally. And on the input on your left, there's a kinship frame that has ego and father and mother and so on. And you can integrate these so that in the blend, Paul is the father and Sally is the daughter. This is a simplex blend, and it seems to be one that many mammals can do. So, for example, if you have a dog that is learned from its dogs are always misleading because they're domesticated. They have been bred to serve us, or maybe we've been bred to serve them. That seems to be what goes on in domesticating. There's combined pressure on both species. Well, if the dog has learned to play fetch with only its master, but another human being shows up, the dog seems to be able to understand, we cannot interview the dog, but from its behavior, the dog seems to be able to understand that another human being can be in the role of something that throws the stick, indeed, the dog will get the stick sometimes and try to put it in your hand. That's a simplex framing. It's putting somebody new into a frame it has for playing fetch. And it doesn't seem to be very difficult for the dog. It's actually magic. It's really, really, really impressive. But it looks very, very simple, very, very simple to us. Now, there is emergent structure in this blend. It just doesn't look to us like a very big deal. There is now a particular role in the blend, father of Sally. Not just father, but father of Sally. And in fact, you can put different people into that role. So you can say, oh, Paul is Sally's new father. Maybe Sally's mother was married to someone else 10 years ago, and now she's married to this man. And he has certain responsibilities in this role. He might be responsible for paying her parking tickets, or he might be able to excuse her from school, right? This is a new role, father of Sally. Now, this may look like what? This is very basic, but indeed it is. It is very basic. Simplex blending looks basic to us. It doesn't look like Harold and the Purple Crayon. But it is a case in which the constitutive and governing principles of blending is applying to two input spaces of a certain sort, right? Now, in fact, you can walk this up very quickly so that you get from simplex to double scope. And so here, please notice that there's a Klein. It's not that this is either simplex or mirror or single scope or double scope, and it's just in these little pigeonholes. So I can say Zeus was the father of Sarpedon. From Mount Olympus, he watched his mortal son die. Now, Zeus is immortal, but Sarpedon is mortal. So now we have an interesting blend in which, of course, the father is going to outlive the son. And we have a son that has an immortal father. Zeus is the father of Athena. She was born out of his head, fully clad in armor. Now notice, Athena has no mother. She does not have a childhood. She comes out of his head. It's an interesting blend because his head is sort of a container in a way like a womb in a woman that is a container. A lot is coming in from birth, but not the woman and not the womb and not the mating. The usual kinship frame has got father and mother. But in this blend, only the father comes down, not the mother. Joseph was the father of Jesus. Now notice that in the story, Joseph did not impregnate Mary. But one can say Joseph was the father of Jesus without any difficulty in many communities. What it means is he was married to the mother. He had certain kinds of authority and responsibility. The Pope is the father of all Catholics. The Pope is the father of the Catholic Church. George Washington is the father of our country. Newton is the father of physics. Fear is the father of cruelty. Now notice here there are no people. Well, there are people because only, you know, people fear and people are cruel. But fear is in the role of father and cruelty in the role of the child. So what you can do with a kinship frame is, believe me, I wrote a book called Death is the Mother of Beauty on just this point. What you can do by integrating a kinship frame is all over the lot. One of the things you can do is say Paul is the father of Sally, or the child is father of the man. That may seem very confusing, but one way to interpret it is that the man is influenced by whatever his childhood was. And the child, then, is formative for the man that the child will grow into. So even the same person at different spots can be framed by father and son. Okay? Now, there are others, of course. Frame compatible networks. Sometimes what you're doing is taking two frames where one is, or sometimes what you're doing is not taking a frame that applies to a domain it's meant to apply to, or two frames that clash and you're blending them with one of them in control, or two frames, this is double scope, two frames that clash, and you're blending them and taking parts of each frame for a new frame in the blend. Sometimes what you're doing is taking one frame and another frame, and they nest very nicely. So suppose you have a frame for sports event, and you have in sports event a fan, right? That means somebody who likes the sport and pays attention to it. And now you develop a new frame for a new kind of sport. Maybe it's bicycling, or it could be anything, frog jumping competitions. And here are the frog jumping competitions, and over here are the fans. And you combine these frames, and now you have a fan of frog jumping competitions. And there's no clash between them. They combine. You can say, for example, back in the days when we had spies, we still have spies, but there was it was in spy novels, the idea that when the cultural exchange happened, they'd send the symphony orchestra from one country to another, and you'd always include a spy. So you could say something like, the last second violinist is always the spy. And there's no inherent clash between the frames. The person could be both the last second violinist and in that music frame and the spy over in the espionage frame, right? So I throw this one in, the frame compatible, just to stop us from thinking that something has to be one of these particular standard kinds of networks. Now, we saw that one of the great things that blending can do is create a blend that is at human scale. It is built for the way we operate and the way we think. And using that blend, we can then understand a network that is complex and not built for the basic patterns of human understanding. We can understand the network partly because it has the blend. Now, once you have a blend that takes in part of the network and becomes at human scale because it has received certain kinds of selective projections, then it is at human scale. It wasn't before, but now it is, and you can use it again. So often what you get is blends becoming input to networks, and the blends in those networks becoming blends in another network, and you can build human understanding all the way up. So think of something like numbers. Now we use complex numbers, Hamiltonians, quaternions, imaginary numbers, but we don't start off the child saying, oh, we're just going to teach you complex numbers right at the beginning. No point going through that old history of learning counting numbers first. No. The child first learns counting numbers. That's a blend of walking and numbers of things in a basket. And then you have to introduce the idea of zero. Zero came up very late in the history of mathematics, and it's an achievement for a child. But once you have zero, now it's a number, and it seems as if it's at human scale. And you can walk the child just as history walked up through proportions. That's not so easy. Many, many children have difficulty with fractions. Many human beings have difficulty with fractions, and there's a reason for it. Rational numbers violate a lot of the pressure on blending. They go against some of the governing principles. Anytime you find a culture spending a year trying to bang something into the heads of children, you can tell yourself this is not congenial to basic human mental conception, right? And once you get rational numbers, it seems, who could have any problem? But in fact, if you look in The Way We Think, the book, we explain why people have problems. In fact, this is a very inventive blend with emergent structure. And so on all the way up. You get a blend. Now this is something you understand. It seems at human scale. It's second nature. Because of conceptual integration, we, unlike any other animal, have the ability to have not just conditioned knowledge, where somebody has conditioned us to respond in a certain way. We have the ability to have a kind of second nature that is to take things that are not at human scale, but they feel at human scale, like reading. Reading has only been around at most 8,000 years. It is not an evolutionary product, right? And it took human beings at least 40,000 years to develop writing and reading. It was not easy, right? Nobody thinks there's a module for writing and reading, right? But once you've got it, you look at it and it seems completely straightforward. When you look at the letters on the page, or when you look at the marks on the page, you can no longer see it just as marks on the page. It's words. You can't look at the writing now without seeing the words. It's human scale. It's like looking at the dog or the flowers. There it is. It seems completely, completely natural. So we get this fictive interaction in these blends, and you remember the standard way of talking about the evolution of ideas is we say things like, Kant disagrees with me on this point, right? Now, there's no real agreement there possible in the inputs because Kant's not here, this person's not here. In fact, Kant is not even aware of the modern philosopher. In the blend, we have a fictive interaction, and that lets us understand the network. Here is the blending network for debate with Kant. This is not at all an unusual thing for human beings to do. On the contrary, they do it all the time. It's the basic way. You saw fictive interaction in the six runners from different decades who are now all put together on one track so that in the blend you have a human scale situation. It's really quite elaborate. It gives you language for referring to the network. You can say things like, Hikam El-Garouche beat Roger Bannister. Defeated Roger Bannister by 120 yards. Again, these things are completely ungrammatical for the input spaces, but they are grammatical for the blend, and we use them to understand the network. You saw double scope networks in which you have frames that clash and in the inputs, like drawing and understanding physical reality, and a blend is created that takes parts of each frame for its own frame. It's not that single scope is where one of the frames controls and subordinates the other, and material from the other frame comes in subordinate to the frame of the other. That's single scope. I don't think there are really any pure single scope networks because human beings, as soon as they start to have a single scope network, immediately start running the blend and get double scope structure in there. Double scope is when you have a frame in the blend that has frame-level structure taken from each of the two inputs and develops some of its own. So, for example, in the blend in Harold and the Purple Crayon, you now have the ability to move by drawing. This is a kind of physics you've never seen before. If you want to be home, you draw your house and your home, right? If you want light, you draw the moon and you have light, right? That is emergent structure. Now, this happens all over the place in art. Here, for example, is Magritte's Tentative de l'Impossible, and what the painter paints is real. That's Magritte looking at his wife. And you have to sort of decide what the selective projection is to the blend. Is she aware that she's coming into existence, for example? Or is she just inanimate until it's completed? There are similar kinds of decisions you have to make in construing the network in Harold. For example, if he makes a mark by mistake, does it count? You know, we have erasures when we're drawing. There are no erasures in Harold's world. If you draw it, it's real. So without intending to draw something, he can draw it, and then he has to deal with it. And so what's happening in these kinds of networks is there is a representation link. The element and the representation are blended into a unique element in the blend. So when Harold draws the moon, the drawing is the moon. In the blend, the drawing is the moon. There's also often an analogy link between the object and its representation, not always by any means. Semioticians would talk about all the various different ways of representation. And those get compressed into a unique element in the blend. Now, I'm going to spend a little time on this slide. Blending is basic. Because of the way I've introduced it here so that you can see blending and its principles of operation, it can seem special. In fact, My claim is, and you'll be seeing this in the rest of these lectures, that there's nothing that you do that's higher order human cognition that's possible without conceptual integration. The very looking at each other and understanding each other, my making a gesture coordinated with my language, syntax, meaning, polysemy, all of these are possible for us because we are able to do higher order conceptual integration. You are always using blending all the time. Animals have abilities to do some kinds of blending, and they also have capacities like basic narrative understanding. They can understand that here are some agents, they have to interact with them, that they might be goal-directed. Chimpanzees seem to be able to understand that another chimpanzee is goal-directed. Their basic force dynamics, they have that, right? That's about as far as it goes. They don't have the ability to understand false beliefs. There's no indication that they have any sense of personal identity that stretches over 50 years. They don't have the kinds of things we think of as story. They don't have the kinds of abilities we have for language. Blending is basic. Now, why might this seem odd to say, but you know, we don't see that? Well, that's my next point. And this may be hard to swallow, but I think it's true. Basically, we don't see anything about our cognition because we're not built to. Our mental operations are built for certain real environments, and they're built for us to succeed. In cognitive science, what we are trying to do is to take those mental abilities and turn them on ourselves. But they are not meant to analyze thinking. They are not meant to analyze language. We are tricking them. We are trying to take things that are useful for something else and manipulate them to see a little bit into thinking. So the cognitive scientist is always in a hard position, because consciousness is a thin, weak, tiny, little ability, good for certain kinds of things, like staying on task, focusing on something that you need to learn in a way that it becomes more secure. Like, you all remember learning to read, right? But that's gone. That's back here in backstage cognition now. You don't want to be doing it in consciousness. If you did, it would take you forever. Almost all the important things in thinking are happening in backstage cognition. Now, backstage cognition is very complex, but it doesn't seem that way to us. We look at colors, the yellow looks as if it comes straight in my head, goes in my eye, and registers in my brain. Now, nothing like that is happening. There are no colors in the world. We create colors in our brains because we want to have stability in the world. The apple that is red at noon needs to look red at dawn and at dusk so we can pluck it and eat it and see it, despite the fact that the light is radically different. We discount the illuminant. This is true. This is not controversial. If I hold up a painting that has little squares of color, red and green and so on, and we're in a dark room, and I shine projectors of light that project the wavelengths to which the three kinds of cones in the eye respond. There may be some women who have a fourth. So maybe when you have those marital disagreements about how the coloring should be set, there's an actual biological basis. Maybe. It's a joke. Could be. And I set them to normal white light settings. And you see this color as red and this color as green on this painting. If I take a spectrometer and I measure the light that's being reflected from the red for each of the wave bands, and I measure the light that is being reflected from the green for each of the wave bands, I know exactly what light is being reflected from the red and the green. And now I change the projection on the three projectors so that the light that is now coming from the red is exactly what used to be coming from the green. I mean exactly. What color do you think the red will now look? Answer? Do you understand this? I have red, I have green, I measure the light, I change the projectors, now from the red is reflecting exactly the light that used to be reflected from the green. What color does the red one now look? Almost everybody thinks it looks green or it looks like a blend or something. No, it looks red as red can be. It still looks red. Because how you see a color is not determined by the light that's reflected from the surface. It's vastly more complicated than that. But it will never seem that way to us. And that's the story for almost everything we can think. We are built for small stories. We are built to break the world into events like moving the flower and objects, like the flower. Physics does not break it that way. In physics, every object is an event, and every event is also an object. We are built to think that we have a personal identity, despite the fact that we change radically over time. Almost everything that we think is, if you looked at it just for itself, false. It doesn't stand up. It's not what you would want to have in a scientific theory. But the way you understand things, even scientific theories, is by using the patterns you have for thinking, and you never, ever get beyond them. So this raises a question of truth and science, right? So, for example, when you are looking at an equation for velocity, you may graph it in two dimensions. So here's the time and here's the distance, time versus distance. It's great. It's wonderful. It's right there in front of you. And someone may say, well, but wait a minute. The rocket moving is three-dimensional, and your time and distance, that's two-dimensional. So this is false, so you can't use it. Well, of course it's inconsistent. Of course it's a simplification. Of course it's wrong. But the point is, don't focus on whether or not the blend is true or a particular space is true. The question is whether the network is useful. Now, you could say, oh, well, the two-dimensional graph is a projection of three dimensions onto two. But notice that that's false. In the world, there is never a projection of three dimensions onto two. We have no experience of that. That's something we can manufacture by blending. And it's extremely useful, and it leads us to the truth. Now, Harold does the same thing. The world that he's moving in is three-dimensional, and his paper that he's drawing on is two-dimensional. And so we might say, well, there's some kind of inconsistency here. Harold's brain doesn't work right. He's using two dimensions for three dimensions. But that's not the way to look at it. Using the two dimensions is something we do all the time to make a compressed human scale manageable blend. The important thing is the network, whether or not there is truth in the network or usefulness in the network. We compress things. We make stories. We make stories out of almost everything. Where I story, I mean agents that interact, and a small number of them. So, for example, we do this all the time in science, and this is how we are able to have science. We are not able to operate at subatomic levels or at relativistic distances of time and space. We don't have any experience of that, but we can conceive of them by using basic human capacities for story and compression and blending. And we're not deluded. And it's not just for exotic things. So, for instance, we say something like, the acid etches the metal. We're putting agency in the acid. Now, we know when we think about it that, in fact, the agency is as much in the metal as it is in the acid because it is an interaction between the acid and the metal. Already thinking of it as an interaction is useful to us. Thinking of it as an interaction that's driven by one agent, the acid, is very useful to us, and we hold on to this. This is true in mathematics. My first 2 degrees were in mathematics. So, for example, in mathematics, one of the standard things you learn is that a function carries one value into another. Now, that's false. If you have something like a function, a linear function, One way of thinking of that is just as a set of pairs. For every value of x, there is a value of y. But now, suppose we're trying to get the function. There is no function, there is no agent, there is no thing that carries. But we like to think of it that way. It takes this thing from this space to that space. You know, the function adding 1 takes 2 to 3, or turns 2 into 3. Now, of course, it doesn't turn 2 into 3. 2 is 2. It stays 2, and it stays right there, and 2 is never turned into 3. But we understand change. We understand turning the water into ice. There's a beginning state. There's an end state. Very useful to us to think this way. Suppose you have a function that is a rational function, meaning it's got something in the denominator, something in the numerator, right? And that there can be a value of the variable x such that the denominator approaches in 0, okay? So suppose I have some function that's, you know, 3 over x minus 1. We say as x approaches 1, the function approaches infinity. Now, sometimes you'll say it approaches positive infinity if you approach it from the right, and it approaches negative infinity if you approach it from the left. But, of course, there's no approaching. The function doesn't change. These values, these paired values, are always there. What you're doing is taking the human ability with its limited attention to focus on something and say, ah, as I, the human being, focus on different numbers that are closer on the line to 1, this function gets bigger. So we take something that is static, we understand it mathematically through dynamism and the dynamism of human attention, right? It happens all the time. Fictivity is crucial in science and mathematics. Blending makes them possible, because blending makes it possible for us to construct a network that we otherwise would not understand. And the question to ask is not whether the blend is true, it's whether or not the network is useful, whether or not the network stands up. Now, I said I'd spend some time on this slide, and I am. The last part is words do not equal good theories. And here, I really want to caution us. We are nominalists. Human beings tend to think that if we have a word for something, then it exists. And we can, if we had a word A and a word B, we can say, well, what's the difference between A and B? As if there must be a difference. Remember, words are just words. Words are little compressions. Words are not theories. Words are not true. Words are little prompts to us to think. So we have a lot of words that were invented descriptively a long time ago. Almost all of them have Greek names. They're things like category, analogy, synecdoche, apostrophe, catachresis, metonymy, right? Now, there are some that are not Greek, like counterfactual. These are just words. So don't ask questions like, what's the difference between analogy and categorization? Hold on. Step back. Maybe you're being misled by your words. And certainly don't assume that, oh, I see, here's a mental ability, here's a specific mental capacity that's called categorization, and here's a different one that's called analogy, and I want to know which one is working. Category, analogy, metaphor, metonymy, association, abstraction, and so on, these are words for the little things that we see in consciousness. Remember, consciousness is a thin little capacity. Don't assume that what is apparent to you in consciousness is sort of a basic level of science, and science will just make it better. If we did that, we'd say, oh, there are colors in the world. That's true. And now I expect science just to tell me a little bit about how I see them, right? You've probably got, for almost any basic human ability, you probably got it wrong. One of the things about which there is no controversy in linguistics is that human language and human linguistic ability is incomparably more sophisticated than anybody ever imagined. I started natural language programming when I was 17, And we were going to teach the computer how to understand English in a summer. This was ridiculously simplistic. It was absolutely moronic, but we had been raised on Star Trek, in which Scotty says to the computer, "Hey, computer, fire up the engines," you know, and the computer does it. Well, okay, there are computers that do speech recognition now. I use one. This one. I dictate most of the thing, email I do. It's wonderful. It doesn't work anything like a human being works, right? Human language ability is vastly more complicated than anybody imagined, and it doesn't work roughly anything like what our folk theories tell us it works like, okay? So we have to understand that we're in a funny position of trying to use our mental abilities to get past the little tiny folk theories we have about how we work. The hardest thing about being a cognitive science is you really a cognitive scientist or a cognitive linguist is you have to be very perverted. You have to be very contrary. You have to be immediately suspicious of anything that looks obvious. Anything that seems to you natural and factual, instantly wonder what's going on. Because the things that seem easiest to human beings, like vision and language and social cognition, are the hardest things to explain. We thought when we started computer programming, the really hard things to do would be things like automatic theorem proving or chess. Why? Because they seem hard to us, right? So they must be the hardest things. No. Playing chess is nothing compared to social cognition. Just being able to stand up without falling down. Your folk theory is you lock your knees and you stand in place. Completely wrong. You have a constant combination of flexion and extension of all your muscles. It's all running in the background. And if you had to do it consciously, you would fall over, right? So the easiest things, the things that the two-year-olds can do, are the hardest things. Okay, here we go. I want also to indicate that we find a great variety of integration networks. Don't focus on a four-space diagram. We find diagrams that look like these things. And here I warned Professor Li Fuyin that if you printed up all my slides, you would be terrified. I'm just going to run through a bunch of these. We find all kinds of different integration networks. All of these are studies that are published. What we're focusing on here is the mental operation of blending, not any particular diagram. It is possible, or it's always the case, that you have, for any mental conception, lots. You might have blending in it, but you have lots and lots of other spaces that are involved. We are never giving a complete characterization of the meaning that is going on because there are always lots and lots and lots of other spaces that have blending in them. People seem to be able to control lots of spaces in a conversation, focusing on maybe 2 to 4, sometimes 5 to 7, but hundreds of spaces and blends can come up in a single brief section of discourse. There are continuity of principles of blending across many, many different ranges of thought and action. Money and symbols, conception, here's the blend for the dollar bill, gauges, various kinds of controls. Here is a diagram for the way in which Hebrew uses morphological causatives on the verb in order to create a single verb that is causative. Here is a blend from Scott Liddell on the way in which sign language uses elements of the surrounding space that of the physical space. Here's a curtain, there's the rug. Use those things in order to connect to the topic of discussion. Here's a case where the signer, for example, one part of his body is Garfield looking at the master, and the other part of his body is the master looking at Garfield. Scott Liddell has wonderful analyses of blending in sign language. It works in art, as we might get a chance to discuss some other time. Here is one I'll skip over. It works in jokes. Do you guys eat Toblerone chocolate? In Europe, they have chocolates that's shaped like pyramids. So here's an advertisement for Toblerone. And it says, ancient Toblerone-ism. And that's all you need. Now you know, hey, maybe Toblerone has been a religion that has been here forever, or maybe we had astronauts that went back in time and took Toblerone. You can construct all kinds of things off just these two words. Lots of humor. I have analyses of the way in which elliptical and hyperbolic geometry were invented by certain kinds of blends. And if you look in the way we think, you'll see a discussion of the evolution of the concept of number, different kinds of numbers in the history of number. James Alexander has just published a paper called, he's the Knight Professor of Mathematics and Chairman of the Department of Mathematics at Case Western Reserve University, on the way in which blending is indispensable for the development of mathematics. It's in jokes. It's in voodoo. Jesper Sorensen has a whole book on this. It's in counterfactuals. We say something like, put the T in front of the missing chair. The very fact that you can conceive of a missing chair seems simple. Not simple at all. Depends on blending. We'll see some of that. It is involved in various grammatical structures and so on. So I'm now coming to the end of this characterization meant to try to stop certain misunderstandings. Blending is basic. It's indispensable for human higher order cognition. You almost never see it. Everybody has noticed certain kinds of blends. So here's one, the earliest one I've ever found, where somebody not only uses a blend, people have been using blends for 50,000 years, but notices that it's a blend. It's from Aristotle. But until recently, the view was always that blends are very unusual things that come up. They're very witty. That just happened to be, those were the only ones anybody noticed. So it's not that nobody's ever heard of this before. Literary critics, aestheticians, syntacticians, there's this thing called syntactic blending, syntactic amalgams. Lots and lots of people have noticed little parts of this in their fields. And here's another thing. It's very easy to think in blending that there's a set procedure. You start with certain inputs, you project the blend, you get a blend, right? It can go the other way, and you can work anywhere in the network. So, for instance, it may be that we have this understanding of knowing in terms of seeing. We say knowing is seeing. I see that the square root of 2 is irrational, right? It may be, as Chris Johnson has analyzed, that when you start off as a child, you don't really distinguish knowing and seeing. If mommy says, let's see if daddy's in the driveway, the knowing and the seeing are not separated out. They're just one thing. But gradually, over time, you start to be able to separate out the knowing part from the perception part. And so, in fact, the inputs to the blend are developed after the blend, or it would even be better to say that what you start with is not regarded as a blend. You're not making inputs to the blend, but later on you develop, you decompress, okay? Work can be done anywhere in the network, any time. Blends can recruit from more stable structures. Emergence is not only in the blend, it's often in the network. You get new connections in the network that weren't there before. So emergence is not just a property of the blend. And as we saw, there's a system to blending. Now, this can sound as if blending is a key for all mythologies. It just explains everything. It's everywhere. Well, hold on. For starters, it is everywhere. An analysis of higher order human cognition in any field that leaves off out blending is, I think, going to be mistaken or inadequate. But in fact, blending is very small. Remember, higher order double scope blending seems to have only been here 50, 60, 70, 80,000 years like that, or something like that. The world didn't need double scope integration. All those species did just fine. And we can't do double scope integration without that 2 billion years of evolution run up of all the other things that we've got. It's just that this is the most recent kind of thing. In the grand scheme of things, blending is very small. It does happen sort of everywhere. But think of categories. You categorize everything. You categorize grammatical relations. You categorize furniture. Does that mean categorization is a theory of everything and explains? No. It's everywhere. But blending is actually a very small, double scope blending is actually a very small extra addition, but it makes a huge difference to what we can do. Blending is not a reductionist program. It is not the case that, oh, you say, hey, this is a blend, and then all those other things, polysemy, you know, all that other stuff you don't have to talk about. No, of course not. You need all those other things as well. Okay. So there are a lot of areas in which blending research is being done. You can just go to blending.stanford.edu to see them. And just to remind you, blending is basic. Doing cognitive science is hard. We have to reconceive our notion of truth and science and conceptions and what it means to have truth. Words are not good theories. Now I'm going to show you a blend that I think you've probably never seen before. It's a double scope blend. It's going to look pyrotechnic. Back we go to the exotic stuff. Okay? You may regard it as funny. Some of you may regard it as offensive. That's the point. If you regard it as funny or offensive, that means you understood it. And it also means that it's powerful. Right? So that's what I'm going to do here. Right? And as scientists, you know, we don't just look at what we like. We don't look at, if we're a botanist, we don't say, well, I'm only going to look at flowers. I'm going to pretend that weeds are not in the world. We have to look at actual human cognition. Okay. So this is called the engineer's view of the sexes. So in the top one, we have an on-off switch, and it's called men. And in the bottom one, we have every kind of calibrating gauge working together that you can imagine, and it's called women. Now, over here, gauges for controlling machinery is one kind of frame, and over here, the psychology of human beings is another kind of thing. And this is a double scope blend if there ever was one, right? But everybody instantly understands that this is trying to say something about the relative complexity of male versus female psychology. Now, it may be simplistic, and it may be wrong, and it may be offensive. But the point is, nobody has any difficulty understanding it, you know? Here's something that one of my children said. We're lucky we're not chickens. If we were all chickens, you, William, would be about Elizabeth's age, you, Peyton, would be about Dad's age, and me, Dad, and Mom would all be dead of old age. We are all five alive. We are lucky we are not chickens. Okay? Kid said this when he was eight, just popped out at dinner. Kids say things like this all the time. Now, over here we have human beings, and over here we have chickens. Now, the important thing is not that you can blend human beings and chickens. You've been here for a day, so you know how that works. Why, for example, can Peyton be alive if he's Dad's age in the blend, but Dad is dead? I mean, Dad has Dad's age, right? No. It's because in the blend, Peyton would be about Dad's age, means at the stage of life that a chicken is in, analogous to the stage of life that Dad is in, right? Notice we have language. Peyton would be about Dad's age. Kids love talking about things like dog years, okay? That's not the part I want to focus on. The part is something you're not going to notice. Lucky. Suddenly, in the blend, we are lucky. That's new structure. That's emergent structure. Here are a bunch of chickens, and they live the way they live. Here we are at the table eating our spaghetti or our rice, and we just are the way we are. In neither space are we lucky. Lucky is not even in the conception. But now, in the blend, we're either old or dead if we're chickens, right? So suddenly, the situation we are in now has a counterfactual. The counterfactual is one in which we're dead or old. So the compression of that counterfactual link between those spaces into our present reality is brought in as a feature. And the feature is lucky. We are now lucky inside that space. Because in the outer space connections, there's this counterfactuality, and we very much prefer to be in this one instead of this one, and we are in this one. So that's, now we have a feature. It's like being yellow, only we're lucky. And this is, there are many words like this in the language that tell you, I want you to take network structure and compress it into something in the blend. Words like accident. We say this thing is an accident. What that means is there's a certain relationship in the network. Or you're unlucky, or you're safe. Ron Laniker would say, if you have a word like dent, you have a dent in something, it's only a dent because in the network, compared to something else, there's a disanalogy. Hapless, mistaken, right? These kinds of words, which just seem lucky, just seem perfectly obvious to us that we are lucky. We're right here. It's like being 5 foot ten. It's like being brown. It's like being, male. You're lucky. It becomes a feature because we understand features. Network structure gets compressed into something that is in the blend. So now, to end, it's going to take me 5 minutes. I'm going to give you a pyrotechnic example. And this time, I'm going to go through the various features of blending and talk about the language, right? But don't be confused by the fact that this is a pyrotechnic exceptional example. I'm using it so you can see. Remember that these features are basic. This is a passage from Racine's Phaedra, which was brought to my attention by Gilles Fauconnier. There was a king, Theseus of Athens, and he went down to Crete and he defeated the Minotaur. Do you know this story? I'll have to tell it carefully. He goes down to Crete and he defeats the Minotaur. The Minotaur is a monster. And Phaedra is the younger sister of Ariadne, and Ariadne falls in love with Theseus. And she helps him out with the Minotaur by giving him a thread. So when he goes into the maze to fight the Minotaur, he can find his way out again by following the thread. We call this the thread of Ariadne, fille d'Ariane. And Ariadne got put away. She became a priestess of Dionysus. And Theseus ends up marrying the younger sister, Phaedra. But this is not before Theseus and Ariadne have had a son, Hippolytus. Hippolytus is a beautiful, strapping young man, and he has grown up. Now, Theseus is away adventuring or doing whatever he's doing, and Phaedra is there alone with Hippolytus. Now, remember, Phaedra is considerably younger than Theseus. Phaedra and Hippolytus are not that far apart in age. And Phaedra develops an absolutely consuming passion for Hippolytus. And she fights against it, and she fights against it, and she fights against it. But you can't fight against the gods. So one day, she's hanging out in the palace, and Hippolytus notices that, you know, she's doing just fine, and says, don't you miss Theseus? That's Hippolytus' father. And so this is Phaedra talking to her stepson, Hippolytus. And she says to him, yes, yes, I miss him. I want him. I love him. Not the way he is now, profligate, unfaithful, chasing all the girls, going away, and so on, but the way he used to be. Okay, now this is an analogy, and not a hard one to follow because Hippolytus is the son of Theseus. Of course they're analogous. Hippolytus is a prince, right? So you've got this analogy. You've got two stories. One is over here with Theseus, Phaedra and Theseus. The other one is over here with Phaedra and Hippolytus. Two separate spaces. And she makes an analogical connection between Theseus and Hippolytus. He had your carriage, your eyes, your way of speaking, blah, 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 blah. Why, she says, why couldn't you have come down to Crete and saved us from the Minotaur? Well, of course, the answer is he wasn't alive at the point, but so what? You can imagine it. You could have done this. You know, you were too young. Couldn't you have come on the boats? You know, you could have saved us from the Cretan monster. And now we have a blend. Now there is a space in which Theseus, who saved them from the Minotaur, is being blended with Hippolytus. And now in the blend, it's Hippolytus who saves them from the monster. And she says, you know, you could have been the one that my sister saved. And then she says, no, actually, I would have been the one. So suddenly, the analogy between herself and her sister is compressed, and now she is saving Hippolytus from the Minotaur. I could have given you the thread. And then she says, no, a thread would not have been enough. I would have gone into the labyrinth with you. And she is able to say, you know, I would have gone ahead with you. My love would have made me think of this idea. Now she can talk about her love in the blend, right? For the person who saves them from the Minotaur. Now that's not hard because, of course, it was Theseus who saved them from the Minotaur and she's her husband, right? Okay. And then she said, I would have gone in with you. I would have saved you. I would have walked before you. And Phaedra, in the labyrinth, would have gone into the labyrinth with you to be with you and to be saved or to be lost. Now, Hippolytus does not miss what's going on in the blend. He says, Madam, have you forgotten that Theseus is my father? And she backs off and says, well, what do you mean? You know, why do you challenge me? Basically, can't you do a little analogy? But there's extraordinary emergent structure in this blend. There are two separate mental spaces. There are connections across them. We have projection to the blend, emergent structure. Hippolytus is there. She saves him. They get married there together. And she's able to say things like, your lover, to refer to herself, because that's true in the blend. And my love, things that she could never say up here in the scene in which they are in, and that were not true in the scene in Crete, are now able to be said of the blend. And he says, oh, I'm sorry, you're right, it is just an analogy, basically, I'm backing off. But this is the famous avowal scene. This is the scene in which she avows her love for Hippolytus. And she says, ah, cruel one, you understood me only too well. So here's what we want to see. Lux pyrotechnic. There is a mapping between elements in the two stories. Hippolytus, Theseus, Phaedra, Ariadne. I won't go through it. There are lots of mappings. Identity, analogy, similarity, causality, change, time, intentionality, space, role, part whole, representation. We could go through some of these in this, but they're there. There is selective projection. Only some things come down from the input spaces into the blend. There is emergent structure, really spectacular emergent structure. Now Phaedra and Hippolytus are lovers in the blend. Okay, where they certainly are not any other kind of place. So this may look, what I want to impress upon you is that when we talk about extremely simple things like Paul is the father of Sally, when we talk about the evolution of number, when we talk about Racine's Phaedra, when we talk, as I will this afternoon, about certain basic grammatical clausal constructions, that feels to you like different stuff. Fine. But it only feels to you like different stuff. Don't assume that it is. Of course it is different. We have to explain why these things feel differently to us. But underlying all of them is a basic mental operation that makes human higher order cognition possible, and indeed makes language possible, and that will be part of the subject for this afternoon. Thank you very much.